Hello again to crew and passengers alike, and welcome to the newsletter from Gaiaspora.org, offering Gnostic intel and Sophianic insight on events and issues of today. This is issue number 5, presented by your friendly homegrown telestis, John Lash. The title is Romantic Individuality. As I open this newsletter on November 21st, 2014, I stand on the threshold of a great experiment. You know how we do love experiments in Planetary Tantra. Of course, Planetary Tantra itself is an experiment constructed by the human mind for the purpose of understanding and engaging in another experiment. Well, there you go. That's one way you could describe Planetary Tantra. An experiment intended to investigate another experiment. The supreme experiment of which I speak is, of course, the divine experiment on this planet. And what is the divine experiment? Well, from the cosmic point of view, it is the scenario of human life set in the planetary habitat, considered as a theater of possibility. Now, how would any human animal, such as you or I, come to understand what happens in that theater of possibility or what is anticipated to happen from the viewpoint of the pleromic aeons? Well, I contend that that question is better than any question or proposition that comes from any religion ever devised on this planet. In fact, I would certainly insist that religions do not address the question of the divine experiment. They do not even introduce the concept. Nor does science, really. So you have to look to the Gnostic science, which considers the living earth from the point of view of living knowledge, that is to say, Gaian biophysics. So we are involved, the human species and all other species as well, in an experiment of Gaian biophysics. Planetary Tantra is a way to frame that experiment so that the human animal becomes more and more interactive with the source of it. Remember the three S's of the Sophianic vision story, the three S's of Gnosticism: the source, the setting, and the story or scenario. The Aeon Sophia is the source of life on this earth and the source of the human genome, the human species, in particular. Due to a cosmic anomaly, she is present in material immanence. That is to say, she is also the setting where the very experiment she conceived and dreamed in the Pleroma now unfolds. And finally, it is within the framework of her story that the experiment in this setting can be understood, and in no other way, I would insist. So Planetary Tantra is a great experiment. The GNE was a particular 3-year experiment within the framework of Planetary Tantra. And now, oh yes, now, now, I stand with you on the threshold of what might be, perhaps, the greatest experiment of all. I can certainly say this. Well, 2 things come to mind. First, I can assure you that the launching of the Calico War Party, which is imminent, That is to say, 2 or 3 days, is an experiment which I consider to be among the top 5 projects I have ever undertaken in my life. So I rank the Calico War Party right up there with the Terma and with the GNE. I rank it right up there with the writing of Knott in his image. And I'm happy to say that I've lived this life long enough to be able to stand here at this moment on this day with what I know and my particular skills and talents, which are so complementary to yours. And I can say that this experiment is a challenge like no other. This experiment of the KWP goes to the heart of Sophia's own designs and purposes. Now, planetary tantra, which emerges from the Terma, is a project of experimental mysticism, as you know. If you go to metahistory.org and click on the banner for planetary tantra, you come to the landing page where I explain what it is, namely the revival of Shaktism, crudely known as the worship of power by scholars of Asian mysticism. Okay, so there's one grand project, the experimental mysticism of planetary tantra. Now fast forward to the GNE. That was a 3-year-long experiment with the intention of learning how to track with human consciousness the processes of reset by which the Aeon Sophia prepared her correction. Now, that's quite an experiment in and of itself. Let's call that an experiment in telestics, in directional psychology, in creative mythology, to use the favorite term of Joseph Campbell. I really do believe, happily so, that the GNE is the realization and demonstration of the creative mythology that Joseph Campbell anticipated in his book of that title. That book is one of the 4 volumes of his masterwork, The Masks of God. And now we come to now. It's always nice each day to come to now, right now. And I say that the Calico War Party is an experiment that goes to the very heart of Sophia's own designs and purposes. Why? Well, here is the simplific beauty of it all, my friends. The Calico War Party is a social experiment. It's an experiment to be enacted, demonstrated, and proved in the social world, in society. You know, we've all heard the analogy of a fish in water who doesn't know what water is. All those creatures swimming around in the ocean don't know that the ocean exists. Well, that may or may not be so. We're not, can't be certain of that. A Gnostic would not be so certain of that, making such a claim. But let's just use that illustration for the purpose of analogy, as often occurs. Trying to explain certain things to people is like trying to explain what water is to a fish. And so I am going to apply that analogy right now at the start of this newsletter in a way that may not have occurred to you previously. What would we say what specific application of that little trope might apply here? How can I make the point I'm making by using that little trope, the fish in water, who knows not what water is? Well, what could we say? Substitute the human being, the human person, let's say human person, substitute the human person for fish, and what do you substitute for water? Think about it for a moment. Well, a number of things come to mind, don't they? A number of items to slot into that little trope. For instance, you could say, well, consciousness, I guess, you know. Trying to explain to a human being about consciousness is like trying to explain to a fish about water. You could go there. You could use that one. And some others might occur to you. The one version of that trope I'd like to give you right now might perhaps reframe your view of the world. Or it just might leave you blank. I don't know, so let me try it out. Trying to explain to a human person what sociality is like trying to explain water to a fish. Sociality. That is to say, the condition of living in society. In a society. When you look at the world and you place the human animal in the natural habitat along with other species, it's obvious that humans have in common with those other species the tendency to form societies. So seagulls form societies, whales, wolf packs, caribou, ants form societies, bees. What a fantastic array of societies can be observed here in the natural habitat, which is dreamed by the aeons of Phaia. But what is different about human society? What makes human society, if it is different, what sets it apart from these other animal societies, like the society of elephants, which is absolutely fascinating, or like the social behavior of gorillas, or the social behavior of hedgehogs, prairie dogs? Well, if you ponder that question, you actually prime your mind to move in the direction to know how the divine experiment on this planet is set up to succeed. On the Aeon's own terms, on her terms, it's set up to succeed as a social experiment. Why? Because she designed the human animal in such a way that it creates society in a way that differs from all other living species. The creation of a society by human animals, a social order consisting of human persons, is the unique signature of the human species on this planet. And so there's nothing mysterious at the end of the day in the phrase, the designs and purposes of the wisdom goddess. You know, I've been using that phrase for quite a long time now. And when I first introduced that phrase, it was really just a teaser. Well, it's a teaser in my mind as well, believe me, my friends. It was just a teaser. That phrase generates a certain mystique. It generates a certain curiosity in the human animal. Sure, if you tell me that I'm involved in a divine experiment, that is to say, an experiment conceived by a divine superhuman being of pleromic magnitude, I would love to know exactly what it is. Well, guess what? It's not really anything mysterious. It's what's right in your face. That may be the most mysterious thing about it. In fact, I'm convinced now, after all these years, you know, going on what? It's 7 years, 8 years since Not in His Image came out, 2006 to 2014, right? Going on all those years, which have gone by like a flash of lightning, I am convinced that the nature and the dynamics, the success and failure, the challenge of this divine experiment, all those aspects of it can be understood in terms of human sociality. Therefore, all we have to do is look at the social order in the human world at this time on the planet, and look particularly at what is wrong with that social order. And through looking at what is wrong and what has gone wrong in this thing we call human society, you come to see in all its depth and splendor the true nature of this experiment. So, that's pretty exciting, because the Calico War Party is an experiment again, specifically designed to operate in the social world. The Calico War Party, the moment it comes out, with the Thunderbird design, the ranks and bands of the 17 points of that design, which are a transfiguration of the Shakti cluster, and the manifesto of the party, all of that comes forth into the first attention of the human animal. It is a social event, it is a social experiment, and it is a social challenge. And I am certain that those who respond to that challenge, whether they know it or not, will find themselves immediately engaged in Sophia's correction. Now, the suspense is getting pretty thick around here. I don't know what you're feeling, but I have been working tooth and nail on getting the KWP ready to launch. And as I do so, of course, I am always vigilant for signals that might show up, random signals, random events in the outside world that might in some way relate to this great project. And I'm just going to point to one of those signals. Remember that my intention in the newsletters is to address current events and topics of the day to the best of my ability and to put them in a Gnostic perspective. So you see here in the text that accompanies this talk, the first link is to a short clip of a late night talk show in the United States featuring the Canadian comedian Jim Carrey. Okay? A Hollywood insider, no doubt. And I'd like to have you just watch that clip for a moment. And then I can give you, you know, the Gnostic perspective on what happens in that clip. I find it somewhat remarkable that Carrey's antics on the stage here combine two powerful symbols, one of which is quite well known, the triangle motif, and the other less well known perhaps, the lolling tongue. Now, what is the triangle motif that he makes? Well, there's a rumor in Hollywood, you know, you perhaps have heard it, a rumor that the Illuminati control the music industry business. Have you heard that rumor? Now, I'm not saying that rumor is true or untrue, and I'm not here to enforce that rumor. I'm merely pointing out that the rumor exists. That is a fact. Not only is it a fact, it is a widely discussed subject. You will find, for instance, numerous long discussions and documentaries, if you will, on YouTube concerning the problem of the Illuminati control of the music business and the movie business. You will find people discussing the claim that the young stars of Hollywood are brought to prominence by a nefarious program. They are stars who do not reach or attain their celebrity by the excess of their natural talent. Some of them aren't talented at all. Rather, it is said that they are placed in those positions of power and celebrity and wealth by the hidden handlers behind the scenes at Hollywood. This may involve MK-Ultra mind control, which has been proposed, for instance, for Britney Spears. And perhaps some of you have seen that remarkable clip of Britney Spears being interviewed by some horrific creature. I think it's Diane Sawyer, in which Britney Spears just totally loses her mind and acts like someone who is being remotely controlled by signals transmitted to her through her subconscious. Well, this is the Manchurian Candidate / MK Ultra mind control syndrome, isn't it? And so there's a big case about this. The hip-hop stars have been displaying with their hands the symbol of the triangle and looking through the triangle at their audiences for years now. So here comes Jim Carrey, who's a buffoon and a clown and a trickster in his own right. A rather funny man in some ways, perhaps a rather sinister man as well. There is a sinister side to comedy, as you may know. And here he is, displaying and flaunting the eye in the triangle and coming out with a little rap saying, "Okay, folks, the game is up. It's time now to blow cover and to come out and say in the mainstream that everything you've heard about the Illuminati running Hollywood is true," and so forth and so on. And Carrey makes his disclosure satirically, of course. So what are you going to believe? Are you going to believe that he's using satire and comedy to reveal something that is true and therefore change the game? Or is he merely doing it in a way that perpetuates the game and perpetuates the hook or hooks that are attached psychically and psychologically to the symbol of the triangle? Well, what I find remarkable is that he combines that well-known and much-discussed symbol with something truly esoteric, and that is the lolling tongue. Now, let me give you a little commentary about the lolling tongue. I don't know if I have actually explained this at any length in previous talks. The goddess Kali is always shown with what is called the lolling tongue, L-O-L-L-I-N-G. It's the kind of tongue that dogs have when they're perspiring, when they're thirsty. It's the kind of tongue that people have when they're dying of thirst. Kali is shown with a lolling tongue. Well, why? Well, there are three points of signification, if you will, contained within that image. The first is that the lolling tongue represents, as I just said, death from thirst. It represents what you see when someone dies from a lack of nourishment or a lack of water. Tongue hangs out. And it can occur in poisoning, too, I believe. So you have the motifs of poisoning. You have the motif of someone at the point of death with their tongue hanging out. And that is a clue to Kali Yuga. Kali Yuga is the age of the lolling tongue, especially the last 200 years of Kali Yuga, which we are now in. The lolling tongue in this sense represents the end and the death of the human species, or the death of a certain way of life. If human animals are living in a certain way of life, then they literally die. They fall on the cremation ground of Kali with their tongues hanging out. So it's a presage of mass annihilation. Okay? Second point. The lolling tongue, you may recall, was used many years ago, back in those innocent days of rock and roll, for the cover of a Rolling Stones album, right? Now, the lolling tongue in that context, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, obviously represents hedonistic excess, an appetite that cannot be satisfied, the consumption of drugs, the consumption of intoxicants, the consumption of bodily fluids, the consumption of pleasure without limit. Of course, the lolling tongue of the Rolling Stones cover is a lurid reference to oral adoration of the female body, but women also can use the tongue in adoration of the male body. Licking, in fact, is one of the primary acts of eroticism, of which human animals are so fond. So licking with the lolling tongue and taking fluids upon the tongue all represent the theme also associated with Kali, which is the theme of addiction. In fact, you can say that the lolling tongue is the signature of addiction. And you know the importance of addiction in the genre of Kala Tantra. From the viewpoint of Kala Tantra and Mayavada Vedanta, the only reason why the universe exists, the only reason why we're here, is addiction. Even the aeons are addicted. They're addicted to gambling. And these experiments are like games. They're like gambling games for the aeons. Okay, and what is the third significance? Extremely occult, extremely esoteric, to be associated with the lolling tongue. Well, you may recall, I once gave an AV briefing called The Terma is a Tray. And in that briefing, I described the supreme ritual of Kali Yuga, which is called tongue on knife. And so the lolling tongue, additionally, in its third dimension, represents that ritual. And that ritual, as I've explained, is the manner in which a Kalika does not surrender his or her addiction, but turns it over to the goddess Kali as an offering. And the goddess Kali, in return, renders that addiction into an actual bodily elixir. And that is such. That is exactly what happens. And everyone who undergoes it knows it to be true. So it's pretty remarkable that Jim Carrey, clowning around in that way, mixes the lolling tongue with the well-known Illuminati triangle, although he says Illuminati, probably to get himself off the hook. I've included here a quote given at the beginning of Michael Hoffman's book on mind control, in which he discusses the revelation of the method. I've cited Hoffman before, and here's a little quote from a book called Clowns, which explains the, let's call it not sinister, but let's just say the trickery of the clown, of the mountebank, who appears to be foolish and appears to be doing something that he's not when he is actually doing exactly what he intends to do. This is characteristic of the trickster. So, that's a little introduction. Didn't expect that it would get me halfway through this news briefing, news letter. So I'm going to move on quickly with the assurance that the Calico War Party will be out there in the world in a matter of days, sooner rather than later. Some of you have asked that I continue to note the navigational parameters and the celestial omens each time I present a newsletter. So right now, today, I would note that we are in completion with Vishvamata, correlated to the constellation of the scales. The shift began back in October on the 23rd, when the crescent moon appeared as a dazzling, elegant sliver in the scales. Well, the coming shift will be marked by the sunset crescent in the snake tamer aligned to the galactic center. And this omen refers to what I shall call the mysterious presence of Panacea. I've decided to use the word Panacea as a kind of goddess or Dakini title in reference to the constellation of the snake tamer. I can now say that I'm getting intel on the snake tamer and on the presiding Diamond Sky Dakini. Finally, I think you know that of all the factors in the real sky correlations to the Shakti cluster, this one has been the most obscure and elusive until now. So I use the term panacea as a clue. It means the cure to all ills. Well, what is the cure to all ills? Think about that. What is the cure to all ills? I would like to be able to comment a little more on this theme when the time comes for the next newsletter and the shift of the snake tamer is underway. But I can tell you for right now that I have the satisfaction of discovering the myth that would be correlated to the constellation of the snake tamer. Just as, for instance, the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice is correlated to the constellation of the scorpion, the myth that can be assigned to the snake tamer is the myth of Gilgamesh. So you might want to go investigate the myth of Gilgamesh, which represents a heroic quest tale. And in that tale, the hero Gilgamesh goes in quest for the herb of immortality, which might be called the cure to all ills. So that's a lovely, rich, delicious, and attractive theme that I intend to take up soon as I am investigating it here in the Sorcerer's Paradise of Andalusia. Now, moving on to the second half of this newsletter, I want to go directly to the topic of romantic individuality. And I want to do so by way of the subject of feminism. But before I do that, I just want to note that I have included some text on the problem of astrological static. I'm not going to go over this text in the talking part of the newsletter because it would take too much time. But it's come to my attention that some of you may be following the Oracle report, and I feel obliged to comment, as I did once already, on that subject of astrology, on the subject of astrology and what is called horary astrology, which you find in the Oracle report and in numerous other astrological websites on the internet. I could cite 10 others. These are sites that purport to give comments on the moment based on astrology. So the Oracle report uses astrology, which is not to be confused with the real sky forensic astronomy of planetary tantra. And so the text there gives you some of the particulars required to understand that Scorpio is not the constellation of the Scorpion. Also, I've written that material specifically to help you understand how easy it is to confuse signs and constellations. I would call that confusion astrological static. It's like when you're listening to a radio program and there is static on the line to prevent you from hearing clearly what is being said. If you follow that astrological intel, you will not be able to hear what is being said in Dakini intel. So please take note of that. Okay, moving on to the subject of feminism. And I have titled this section, The Demise of Feminism. I am happy to announce that feminism is going down the tubes very, very fast, rapidly, and in a most spectacular manner. In fact, if you look at one clip there, you'll see that there was even a poll recently given by Newsweek, I believe, asking people if there was any word they would like to ban from use in public discourse. And feminism came out at the top of the list. People are sick and tired of this subject being used, or this term being used, as a weapon to bludgeon anything that feminists do not approve of. There are a lot of anti-feminist jokes out there. There are a lot of anti-feminist posters and sayings. One of the most common ones, for instance, is, it's only sexist when men do it. So if I meet a woman in a bar and she has dressed herself in such a way that she has an attractive cleavage and she's parading around in such a manner that it's difficult for a full-blooded male to avoid looking at her cleavage, well, it's okay if she does that. But if I look at her cleavage and comment on it, that's sexist. And a feminist will bust me for doing that. So the hypocrisy and absurdity of feminism is coming to the fore. The video regarding banning the word feminism comes from a character named Thunderfoot. That is a YouTube name of an MRM, Men's Rights Movement, anti-feminist. And it's typical of the current blowback against feminism. Other examples of absurdity can be seen in the clip from Ramsey Paul, who is a political satirist, a white nationalist, and an anti-feminist as well. On the origins of feminism, you might want to educate yourself a little if you don't know that feminism was virtually created or invented as a public relations stunt by Edward Bernays, who was the nephew of Sigmund Freud. You might also want to listen to Aaron Russo in conversation with Nick Rockefeller in that well-known clip. The Rockefeller person explains to Aaron Russo that feminism was simply created by the ruling elite in order to get serve their own program. And finally, if you want to learn a little about the MGTOW movement and men shunning marriage, you might look at the clip from Diana Davison, who is a Canadian MRA, or men's rights activist. You find these two acronyms, MRA and MGTOW, popping up now more and more, MRA or MRM. MGTOW stands for Men Going Their Own Way, and this is a movement that's been around for a while. It's now picking up a lot of speed. Now, I have to say that I do not consider either of these phenomena, these social phenomena, the MRM or the MGTOW, to be a significant or lasting phenomena. They're really merely symptoms of the collapse of feminism. So just as when a building collapses, there's a lot of dust, there are boards and nails flying around, there are cement blocks crashing against each other, there's a lot of debris and chaos, I see MRM and MGTOW as part of the debris and chaos produced by the collapse of feminism. I do not see anything lasting or viable or sustainable in either of these movements. Now, I do enjoy the sober and mischievous delivery of Diana Davison. happens to be one of the MRAs that I follow, I've said before that when women speak for men and men speak for women, the healing of the gender rift is demonstrated. Diana Davison speaks for men, and what some of the things that she covers that are being accomplished in the MRM are valuable. For instance, the legal system has long ago been co-opted by the feminists and rigged greatly to their advantage and unfairly and cruelly against men. And so men are punished in the legal system due to the hijacking of that system by the feminists. So the bringing the system back into balance legally is one of the projects and prerogatives, or priorities, I should say, of the men's rights movement. And I'm not against that, of course. But in terms of the Gnostic and Sophianic perspective on the gender rift, well, in that perspective, these two movements don't really count for much. By the way, correction, MRA is men's rights advocacy or advocate. So an MRA is a man or woman who wants to right the balance, right the scales, as it were, and bring the rights of men as regarded in legal terms and in the terms of the social contract back into more balance with the rights of women. The rights of women have been falsely and deceptively elevated over the rights of men for some decades now, and this is part of the corruption and distortion that comes directly out of the feminist movement. I am certain that my rather dismissive attitude toward MRM, and particularly MGTOW, will not be regarded with pleasure by the people who are now pouring themselves heart and soul into these movements. Nonetheless, I intend to show, off and on, in the coming newsletters, the triviality and non-sustainability of these movements, particularly MGTOW. Let me say a little bit about MGTOW right now, as far as I understand it. MGTOW, meaning men going their own way, looks to me like nothing more than an elaborate orchestration of an adolescent snit fit against women. One of the aspects of MGTOW behavior would be like this. If I'm a MGTOW, I'm a man going my own way. Well, how do I show that I'm going my own way? Well, I go through my day and I ignore women. So I get up in the morning and I go down to the coffee shop to have my coffee and a donut. And I don't look at the lovely ladies who might be lounging around at various tables. I just ignore them as if they're not there. I present a deadpan expression to the woman at the counter, who may be an attractive young woman. I don't bite the bait. I don't respond to that. And that is that method of ignoring or disregarding the presence of woman and the attraction that woman exerts upon man is a mark of MGTOW behavior. I mean, how silly is that? That is like something, it reminds me of me when I was like 15. I was in high school in Waldoboro, Maine, and I think I was in the sophomore year, and I had like a number of girlfriends. I always had a number of girlfriends. I think I had like 5 or 6 on the string at that time in my sophomore year. And well, you know, I was pretty pissed off because I wasn't getting what I wanted from those girls. Inconceivable that I could have gotten it in that time and setting. But nevertheless, I wanted something that I wasn't getting. You can guess what that was. And I got really pissed off. So one day after school, I went into the room, the typing room, where we learned how to type. And I put a piece of paper in one of the old typewriters there, you know, one of those old Royal models. And I typed out the names of the 5 girls that were currently in my sophomore entourage. And then I cut those names into little strips so that they were on 5 strips of paper. And I put them in my hand, in my palm, and I closed my palm, and I jostled them around, and I picked out three of those names, and I never talked to those three girls again for the whole rest of the school year. That kind of stunt reminds me of what the MGTOW are doing. I perhaps am misrepresenting MGTOW, but I have to say honestly that I do not see how their movement can go anywhere. I don't understand if MGTOW implies or entails a complete rejection of women to the point of celibacy, or what are they going to do? Go to other men for sex? Are they going to go to barnyard animals? What are they going to do? Stuffed animals? I have heard only one MGTOW commentator, which is on Thinking Ape TV, a guy who takes himself very seriously, who states openly that celibacy is the option for MGTOW now. Well, this is insane. There appears to be a rejection of woman in MGTOW that totally excludes the sexual dynamic. And as far as I'm concerned, that path of behavior for men can have no future. Now, I'm distinguishing the rejection of sexual involvement with women, if indeed that be the policy for MGTOW or some MGTOW individuals, I'm distinguishing it from the rejection of marriage. You'll see that I have included here a clip from Feminism LOL, the YouTube channel of Diana Davison, in which she talks about men rejecting marriage. There's more and more talk about men rejecting marriage. That discussion falls squarely in the center of the men's rights movement, because the marriage and divorce laws and alimony laws are so unfair to men. Recently, the comedian Robin Williams committed suicide. Among the many people commenting on that, and by the way, when a comedian commits suicide, it's not funny. Among the many comments on that, there was a lot of talk about his alimony problems and the millions and millions of dollars that he owed to an ex-wife or two. So the rejection of marriage, that's something to consider. Recently, I had a delightful moment here when a visitor came to Ambergain, a woman shaman who also lives in Spain, and she announced to me and the men present that as much as she was devoted to her partner, husband, and loved him, and they loved each other deeply, she recently just renounced all of their marriage vows. So I took this as a great step toward the healing of the gender rift, because it doesn't mean that she renounced the love or the intimacy. It simply means that she renounced any external construct around that love and intimacy, because the external conventional constructs that make human mating acceptable in societal and legal terms are no longer valid. They do not belong to the solution. They are part of the problem. So it was hugely encouraging and timely for the visit of this woman, friend and ally, who had made that choice, who had made that recent decision in her life, acting purely out of her own intuitive and moral impulses. I'm quite sure she doesn't know anything at all about the MRM or the MGTOW movement. How does the subject of MGTOW in particular relate to the topic of this newsletter, romantic individuality? Well, it relates keenly to that subject. In the reaction formations against femininity that can be observed in MGTOW, note my language there, several factors are included. One of these factors is the rejection of chivalry and the white knight complex. You hear certain terms used in MGTOW discourse. Mangina, Chivalry, White Knight. These three terms together represent a reaction formation against of men against their own behavior toward women. Do you follow that? So basically, the MGTOWs are saying, first of all, I won't be a mangina. A mangina is the derogative term for a man, a pussy, a man who is a wussy, a pussy, a man who has sacrificed his true manhood and the prerogatives of being a man through intimidation by feminism or through some sad delusional notion of how men should serve women. MGTOWs reject this. They reject the white knight idea. Men are not here to serve women. We're not here to open and close doors for them. We're not here to protect them. And so forth and so on. So chivalry would be considered by a MGTOW as one of the most objectionable of concepts possible for a man today. Well, I contend that that is not at all the case. And in order to build my case for romantic individuality, I want to take you back to the age of chivalry. But I want to take you there with yours truly as a guide. I've included, along with this newsletter, in PDF form, Chapter 5 of The Hero, Manhood and Power. That chapter is called Tragedy and Transfiguration, I think. And it is dedicated to a discussion of romantic love and chivalry and the code of manners in the medieval Arthurian period. So a consideration of that material in Chapter 5 of The Hero, it takes you back 1,000 years. It takes us back 1,000 years. Why go back 1,000 years? You might easily think that is a hell of a long ways to go back, and it might be considered to be a nostalgia trip, you know. Oh, let's go back to the Middle Ages. Let's go back to chivalry and, you know, white knights and ladies and jousting tournaments. Well, that's not really what I'm proposing. I'm actually proposing a look back to that period in order to come forward with some of the values of that period, the values and themes. And you'll find them specified in this chapter I've extracted. You find that I have to refer to the language of the Languedoc, which means the language of Oc, Languedoc. And Oc was the medieval word for yes in French. The current word for yes in French is oui, spelled O-U-I. But way back in those days, in that part of southern France called the Languedoc, which is also known as the Pays Cathar or Cathar country, they said oc instead of we. And oc is also the first syllable of the language that they spoke, which is called Occitan. Now, Occitan, O-C-C-I-T-A-N, is a mix of French and Spanish. As a matter of fact, there's a famous Cathar castle in southern France, in the region of the valley of the Aude, the river Aude, which flows past Carcassonne. A little further south and to the east of Carcassonne, there's a famous Cathar castle that is literally erected in the sky, and it is called Puy-Lorenz. I went to Puy-Lorenz the last time, accompanied by a certain vixen of my acquaintance, in October of 2007. And when you stand on the ramparts of Puy Lorenz, which is one of the most romantic Arthurian, enchanting Arthurian places that I've ever been, probably the most, and you look north, you look down immediately in front of you, and there's a river. Now, you're in France, and you're looking down from this Cathar castle to a river, and that river used to be the boundary between France and Spain. So at one time, Puy Lorenz was actually in Spain. So this Occitan language is a special language used during the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries. And I have to go back and pick up the terms in this language in order to introduce today concepts of a moral and psychological and emotional value that would stand for use in the healing of the gender rift today. So I'm not going back to chivalry to try to revive chivalry. That would be laughable. And I'm sure there's a number of MGTOWs, if anyone, if even a single MGTOW were listening to this talk, he would be spewing out his cafe latte and laughing uproariously at the very suggestion of even looking at the values of chivalry. That the word chivalry evokes a complex in the minds of some men today of everything that they don't want to be in relation to women. But I submit to you that by going back and recovering these terms, it is possible to frame and define a set of contemporary values that reflects the healing of the gender rift. Let me remind you once again of a statement that bears repeating. I said that the solution to the gender rift has already been found. This is such an important statement. If anyone today thinks that we have to go looking for that solution, then they would undertake a futile quest. Because in fact, the solution has been found. What is required then is to recover the solution, to reinstate the solution, if you will. The solution that was found, as reflected in the genre of chivalry and romantic love of the 12th century in Europe, was repressed almost immediately upon its development. It developed in a very rapid period of time, in the beginning around 1120, and it developed for about 200 years, which is nothing but a blip in the timing of the collective life of humanity. And then forces arose against it to suppress it and to make sure that it didn't survive. And so that is why today the concept of romantic love or the cult of love in the Middle Ages is not understood for what it actually is. It's a code of manners and morals for us now, but not to be taken in the same way that it was lived back in those days. It has to be revised and updated and adopted to life today. But all of the essential elements, all the rudiments of the solution of the gender rift can be found in that code of manners. I know that's a strange proposition. It may come across as a bizarre proposition to some people, and some people may tend to reject that as a ridiculous prospect, but I assure you it is anything but. So I intend to show in coming talks exactly how to recover and reframe and restate the romantic code of manners. And I want to show as well that the true individuality of the human person in modern society depends upon that framework, depends upon that ancient code of manners in its current and upscaled form. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean, quite simply, that there is a wonderful condition for individuality to appear in human society in the 21st century. Individuality cannot just appear out of nowhere. It has to have a frame in which to appear. That frame is the relation of the sexes. It is the cross-gender dynamic, male to female and female to male, which largely excludes other gender variations and other gender dynamics. I don't speak for other gender dynamics, by the way. I have an attitude of, let's say, peaceful coexistence, you know, tolerance. But please bear in mind that tolerance is not approval. If I tolerate something, doesn't mean I approve it. So if I tolerate homosexuality, it doesn't mean that I approve it and I'm a champion of gay rights. Tolerance simply means that I don't interfere with that behavior. I don't intend any harm against people who exhibit the behavior of homosexuality, but I don't approve of it. And I have to insist that any other gender relations and gender dynamics apart from heterosexual do not belong to the healing of the gender rift. The two polarities of gender in the human animal are male and female. All variations come from those polarities. So all variations of gender, transsexualism, lesbians, gays, and so forth, are secondary variations from the primary pair. The solution comes out of the dynamic and synergy of the primary pair. So, and if you want to be an individual in society today, a truly powerful individual, an individual who can make a difference, someone who lives according to a sense of mission and purpose, someone who has a visionary sense of life, then you need to understand that you can only become that individual inside this intergender dynamic, the cross-gender dynamic, I'm going to call it, referring to male, female, female, male dynamics. That's why it's called romantic individuality, you see? Because it's born out of romance. Now, I think it's pretty obvious that romance is anathema to the men's rights movement and the MGTOW movement. And romance is something that we don't want and don't need in this world according to their standards. But I submit to you that until I explain what it is, you don't know what romance actually is. You don't know what the basis of romance is, or what even the meaning of the word romance is. Do you know what the meaning of the word romance is? It means that which is described in a novel. Because the French word roman goes way, way back to the Middle Ages, and it refers to a literary genre, the romance, the roman. Roman, R-O-M-A-N, is the short form of the word romance, and a romance was an epic story of a hero framed in the events of that time. containing historical details, such as the romance of the hero Roland, or of El Cid, or the romances of the Arthurian knights. And what would that possibly have to do with life today? It has a lot to do with life today, particularly in respect to the return of the warrior ethos to the earth. It all comes together, you see. Romance, the romantic set of values, the attainment of true individualism, the true morality of love, which is inseparable from the true morality of honor and courage. It all comes back now. It all comes back, and one of the forms it takes is the Calico War Party. Why? Because the Calico War Party represents a warrior class. And romance, in its medieval and original sense, was the celebration of a warrior class. Can you see the logic here? So, in future talks, you'll hear this theme brought up time and time again, and I will elaborate it to the best of my ability. For now, I conclude this spoken part of the newsletter by referring you to a few books that you might want to look into. The essential book on the Romantic movement of the recent Romantic movement of the 18th and 19th centuries is called Natural Supernaturalism. A more difficult book, but essential, is The Romantic Conception of Life by Robert J. Richards. A book to avoid, absolutely, is Courtly Love, The Path of Sexual Initiation by Jean Marcal, although Marcal's book, Women of the Celts, is essential reading on this subject. Finally, if you'd like to read a modern novel which exhibits the pathological reemergence of romance in the modern psyche, take a look at Lilith by J.R. Salamanca, a little-known novel which I would recommend for its exquisite writing and for the depth and poignancy of its message. Finally, I leave you with an image of Puy-Lorenz, Cathar Castle in southern France.